This is Interleaved, where we take a deep dive into topics from the Daf Yomi with modern-day sages of the Torah and the world. I'm Natanael Zelis Palay. On today's episode, the architecture of an ancient world and the text that brings it to life.
You know, an architectural device becomes a kind of metaphor for creating something different, such as a temporary boundary.
Tractate Erevin is Tractate Shabbat's disowned sister. Thousands of learners jump off the Daf Yomi train as it rolls into this unfriendly Talmudic city, entangled with wires, beams, and elusive legal definitions, all about the rabbinic technology that allows one to carry on Shabbat. But underneath all the wood and frustration, the tractate at its core is how people come together through something they build. And Dr. Mitchell Schwartzer knows all about that. Mitchell is a historian of architecture who writes on the urban and suburban built environment. He is professor of architectural history and chair of the Department of Visual Studies at California College of the Arts, where his courses cover architecture, urbanism, art, landscape, technology, and spirituality. He is the author of several books, most recently Urban Development and Disruption in 20th Century Oakland, set to publish in 2021. In addition to his books, his writing has appeared in numerous magazines and journals, including his article on the architecture of the Talmud, which was published in the Journal of the Society of Architectural Historians. Mitchell, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So your expertise and interests are diverse and wide-ranging across time and place. What brought you to the Talmud? And what motivated you to write about its architecture?
I've been teaching the World Survey of the History of Art and Architecture since 1991. And as I've been teaching it over these years, so by the World Survey, I do both parts in a whole year. So I do from caves all the way to the Enlightenment in the first half, and then from the last 250 years, the modern period, in the second half. And especially for the first half, when we talk about Egypt and Greece and Rome and Byzantium and China, India, I realized, you know, that religion was probably the single most important factor in shaping of buildings and the urban environment. And so I started reading more and more about religion in order to, you know, understand why the Greeks did what they did, and or why, let's say, the Hindu architects did what they did. And I started to think along those lines, because the survey about Jewish built space, and I realized that the survey didn't include a lot on that, you know, because there isn't a lot of monumental Jewish built space. There are synagogues around the world, and they really don't get large and monumental until the 19th century. Somewhat, you know, actually the area my parents are from, which is southeast Poland, Galicia, has developed a really fascinating synagogue type called the Fortress Synagogue. That was somewhat monumental, but at the same time, it had to be shorter than the churches in the city, and it had to be less conspicuous. And that was characteristic of synagogue architecture, you know, throughout, let's say, the Middle Ages up to the 19th century. It had to be small and inconspicuous. Jews had to, in other words, assume a kind of modest presence living in a Gentile community. And so I started to think about, well, if religious buildings for non-Jewish groups are so influential in shaping the way those groups both design and practice and relate to each other, how do Jews do it? What have Jews been doing? Like a lot of people I know, you know, have heard about the temple. I've been to the, you know, the wall and the site of where the temple once stood. And I knew a bit about Talmud and Mishnah, but I hadn't really ever delved into it since I grew up Reformed. And so I started reading a lot about Jewish faith, halachic law, Agadah, for several years before I worked on that article. And I came to the idea that it would be really useful for the architectural community, especially to understand how Jews developed a text in the wake of the destruction of the temple that would substitute for some of the activities and rituals that occurred at the temple. And moreover, would actually suffice to bond together, to adhere a Jewish community in the absence of the temple and the absence of a state. Judea was controlled by Rome at the time of the destruction and thereafter, and there wasn't a Jewish state until the 20th century. So that was the idea, you know, that's how it all came about, to understand how, you know, the people of the book developed an interwoven, interleaved book in the wake of the destruction of the temple that both kept the community together and advanced it in new directions.
Definitely a very important article, and I might add, a pleasure to read as well. Leads perfectly into my next question. You open the article, as you said, by suggesting that in a way, Jews built the grand edifice of the Talmud to replace their fallen temple. It's a really intriguing idea that challenges the notion that the Talmud is a messy jumble of successive rabbinic textual traditions without, you know, any sort of intentional architecture. In what ways is the Talmud like a building?
Well, I mean, I think you have to look at buildings as something that also occurs over the course of decades, if not centuries, right? You think about, you know, the Gothic cathedrals. Most of the monumental Gothic cathedrals are built over 200 to 400 years, and some of them almost 800 years. The Gothic cathedral, and this is the case with a lot of great religious architecture, it was really the product of a community over a long time span coming together and changing it. One period might build the west front, another period might build a kind of transept entrance, another period might do stained glass windows. It's the product of a community and over a long time span. And to that extent, I think Talmud is very similar. You know, Talmud is a community endeavor that has been going on close to 2,000 years and will go on into the foreseeable future. It's like a building, and to an extent, it's like a city. It's inhabited. And like buildings and cities, they change with the particular inhabitants you have. I think there is a lot of correspondence.
You mentioned Jacob Neusner's metaphor of Mishnah's theater, where the structure is kind of in place, but the actors are constantly moving and changing.
Yeah, I think that speaks perfectly to what we're talking about, in that, you know, every generation, there are new sages, there are new teachers, there are new scholars who interpret things in different ways and have to, because the world is constantly changing, right? And when the Mishnah and then the Gemara came about, you know, this is a pre-modern era. There weren't modern technologies. And obviously, all of their discussions have to be updated and interpreted in light of what's going on in each successive century, especially the last couple hundred years with automobiles and airplanes and all that.
I really enjoyed a lot of the metaphors in the article, but especially loved your calling rabbis God's surrogate architect. I thought that was cool.
Yeah, they're like almost like there's an understanding that the Torah existed before the world existed. It was a blueprint for the construction of the world, and that the oral Torah came into the world after the world was created and has kind of evolved alongside the creation of the world. And so it is being enacted, literally, right? It's enacted in that it is part of the creation of each generation of humanity. It's different than the written Torah in that regard.
So let's get into the text, or should we say architecture. This first chapter is called Mavoisha Hu Gavoa, which means an alleyway. What can you tell us about the history of alleyways?
Probably one of the oldest cities that we know about is located in Turkey. It's called Katal Huyak, and there is excavation of it. It's preserved under a truss roof, so it's enclosed now. And they've also done drawings of what they think Katal Huyak looked like. We're talking about now about 9,000 BCE. In Katal Huyak, there were no streets or alleys. The city, it had a couple of courtyards, but the passageways in Katal Huyak, in other words, the ways to get around the city, were on roofs. And that's how you entered dwellings. It was for defensive purposes in part. So the entire city is walled and there are ladders to get into the city. And then within the city, you walk on the roofs and then you go down ladders into individual dwellings. It doesn't sound like a great place for seniors, you know. That's about the oldest city we know about. So cities don't have to have streets and alleyways. And I'm imagining most of Katal Huyak was private space. Alleys come about, you know, over time to facilitate, and they come about in the ancient Sumerian cities like Ur and Uruk, you know, and they come about in Egyptian cities. Those are the oldest cities we know that have streets and alleyways. Alleys are a subset of streets. They're just minor streets, I would say. Streets that don't go as far. You know, the way, let's say you have an alley, a street, an avenue, you know, avenue being a larger version of a street. We talk in modern terms about collector streets, arterial streets, a hierarchy of, with regard to width and the amount of activity. And it became expedient on the part of the town authorities to regulate passageways between dwellings and between the religious center of the city. The city actually, these cities had a religious precinct that was walled. The cities were walled and the religious precinct was separately wall. That's often the case. There are often several walled compounds within cities that distinguish hierarchies of social space as well as religious versus profane space. And so there is a history of regulation in world civilizations from China to the West to prevent citizens from encroaching too much on these shared thoroughfares. One can go back and look at laws, you know, from ancient, there are dictates from ancient times and from medieval times, much more even, saying you can only build a balcony so far into the space of the street or alley. You can only conduct this kind of business within the alley. there needs to be certain space for passage. And I think that's been a kind of point of struggle and tension about street space ever since. Because street space typically, alley street space, was typically an area of mixed use. This is a place that people socialized. This is a place people did business and commerce, a place they moved through, a place they entertained and put on shows. And over time, there's been a big struggle, especially in the last 100 years. You know, automobiles, famously, one of the chapters of my book on Oakland deals a lot with this. You know, when automobiles came about by the 1920s, they gradually grabbed hold of street space and took it as their own. And pedestrian, you know, heard the term jaywalking, you know, the idea that pedestrians have to walk in certain areas and at certain times. You know, this is basically a struggle over who controls the public space of the street. So it's a long-standing set of debates about, you know, what is public space versus private space, you know, in the West. I mean, there's no good bound. There's no clear boundary, right, between public and private space. And I know that the Tractat talks about four types of space. In the West, we typically talk about two. You know, private space, it's considered to be intimate, personal, and controlled by a family or an individual. Public space is accessible supposedly to all. You know, everyone can go into public space. And public spaces are in the West are typically understood as streets, alleys, plazas, parks. But then there's a huge gray zone. Like, what is a museum? You know, what is a government office when you go in, let's say, to the building department? Is that public or private? You can't go into the offices, but you can go to the counter to make an application for a building permit. When you go into a store, is that public space or private space? You're allowed in, but there are restrictions, right? But there are also restrictions on what you can do on a street and what you can do in a park and when you can be there. Parks often close. So there's a whole, you know, this is something that urbanists and architects debate endlessly. What is a public space? What is a private space? In our times, there's been a lot of discussion about the erosion of public space, the privatization of public space. You know, as the government has less and less funds, less and less money, you know, public spaces are often deteriorate. Private company, like look at Central Park, right? The quintessential public space. But who maintains Central Park? Largely the Conservancy, which is a private organization, right? And they actually establish certain restrictions on parts of Central Park. You know, what you can do there, you know, and what you can't do there. So it's a very, very interesting gray zone of discussion as to what is the boundary between public and private space.
There's a lot of gray in the tractate too. I think that's what it makes it so difficult. You know, it's one of the three most difficult tractates in the Talmud. And people often assume it's because, oh, well, the architectural, you know, schema, or they're just so hard to imagine the picture, what it actually looks like. I think it might be more because just there are so many different kinds of space. And, you know, so many different legal definitions tied to those spaces. And just to keep track of all of them and the changing definitions, I think that's what makes it so difficult. I also just wanted to point out that I found it really interesting. The opening discussion of the tractate centers on an attempt to derive the maximum height of the mavoi, the alleyway, from the height of the heichal, the inner sanctum of the temple. The Talmud on 3a appears to conclude that this connection is purely coincidental, but it's actually a perfect raya or Talmudic proof for your theory that the Talmud was kind of built to replace the temple, the architecture of the temple. And here we have a whole tractate about architecture, and it begins by discussing the architecture of the temple. I found that really apt.
Yeah, and I think parallel to that is, you know, the synagogues in the Galilee. The, you know, these are the synagogues that were built in the wake of the destruction of the temple in the next 300-400 years. And most of them, you know, they have these amazing mosaic floors, and they also have the Torah Ark. And in most cases, the Torah Ark and the mosaic floors, the mosaic floors have a Torah, they represent the Torah Ark, and those are modeled on the entrance to the Heichal. You know, they were right away. I mean, the synagogue was, you know, it was almost like, here's the temple, you know, and it's with us. Two-dimensional, or roughly two-dimensional, you know, it could be sculptured, but, you know, it's not, we're not inhabiting it, we can't enter it, but it's there, and so we can look, we can move toward it.
Yeah, the Talmud elsewhere calls the synagogue the Mikdash Ma'at, a miniature temple. So that whole discussion about the entrance to the temple is built on the idea that a simple beam, vertical or horizontal, can act as a dividing wall between the Mavoi and the Rishut HaRabim, the public domain, so that people don't unknowingly carry between the two. The Talmud on 5a proposes that the sages disagree as to the exact function of this beam. Rav Yosef is of the opinion that it serves as a marker, a street sign of sorts, to delineate the boundary between the spaces, while Abaye holds that it functions in place of a physical wall. And I love the way you understand the latter position, and really the whole tractate in your article, that the sages architected the laws of Erevin by constructing a literal network of metonymic associations. We have a beam stands in for a wall stands in for a roof stands in for an entire building. From an architectural perspective, it doesn't seem to make much sense. These components all have their own purposes and functions, and they can't really replace each other. A house constructed solely of 2x4s probably isn't going to last very long. What do you think these imagined connections say about how the sages thought about physical space?
If you think about it, right, the core aspect, right, for the construction of the Erev, and the Erev can be constructed out of hard materials, walls. But obviously, if you're going to, let's say you have a modern day city, and this could be Jerusalem or New York, you're not going to be able to build, you know, hard and fast. You have to build something that's temporary and something even that's symbolic and very light. So I think there was an impulse which was present, you know, if you look at the sukkah, right, which is, you know, the whole set of delineations of how to construct a building that is intentionally looks and functions as something that can't be permanent.
Right.
So we have a tradition of that, right? We have a tradition of nomadism. We have a tradition of transitional structures. And so the Erev had to be transitional. It only functions one day a week. It can't construct hard boundaries because it would end up inhibiting the movements of other people. So it has to be, in a sense, symbolic. And I think they use the doorway as the key, right? You know, the post and lintel, right? There's a lot of discussion about the lintel, and because the doorway is the symbol of movement between realms, right? And in architecture, we call it a threshold. And if you look at most religious buildings around the world, it is one of the key moments of that building, the threshold, right? There's often an inner sanctum where there's sometimes a statue of a deity and observance rites. But the threshold, the actual point where you leave the profane realm of the city and you go into the sacred realm of the religious structure, is so important in every culture, right? And it was important in the temple, right? Temple has many thresholds, right? Many realms. And so I think that the metaphor of the doorway is really important, you know? So it was kind of logical, because then you can take then the post and lintel and you can make it into, you know, string and wire, you know, poles and what you can reduce it. And it becomes very, you know, almost like a minimalist sculpture. I don't know if you know the work of Fred Sandbach. He is a sculptor in the 60s and 70s, minimalist art. And he created sculptures out of string. They're very three-dimensional. They're taut. They have tension in certain parts so that they actually can take a 90-degree angle and maintain it. And they're extremely light and, you know, they would function as an, I don't know if they would function as an Erev, they're probably even too minimal. But I think there was that inclination on the part of the rabbis and sages to work from the threshold, the doorway. Because why else do we have the mezuzah on the doorway, right? The doorway is always, you know, you have a mezuzah between the house and the exterior, but you have a mezuzah on every room within the house. So the mezuzah is this constant reminder that you're changing space, and that whenever you change space, you're changing a realm. And whenever you're changing a realm, you should be reminded of who created all this. So the doorway is a perfect metaphor for creating a boundary that is not meant to be impermeable, is not defensive, it's not military focused. It's rather an outward boundary. It's almost like opening your arms. We're going to create this realm, you know, once a week for a whole group of people who can enjoy life more. Because they can now go out, the women can come out with, you know, they can bring the babies and kids, they can go to the park. The doorway worked for that. It, you know, an architectural device becomes a kind of metaphor for creating something different, such as a temporary boundary.
That's an astute way of looking at it. As you point out in the article, the modern Erev, which you were just talking about, is perhaps the thinnest metonymy of all. A wire, often invisible, that stands in place of a wall to enclose a large, often densely populated area in order to transform it into a reshut hayachid, a private domain, where carrying is allowed on Shabbat. The Talmud itself, on 6a, is pretty incredulous of the idea that beams, let alone wires, can affect this transformation. But even the Talmud's idea of this kind of Eruv assumes a Talmudic-era city that had actual walls and doors. Obviously, the modern city looks nothing like that. And modern Eruvin rely on the position of the medieval commentator Rashi, who has a relatively lenient conception of what constitutes public space. What do you make of the fact that the contemporary Eruv walks, shall we say, such a fine line?
In the West, public space is understood, as I said earlier, as a place we come together, we exchange, we meet, we develop community. Without public space, we don't have a sense of community. And Americans are so bad at that, right? We spend so much time in our houses, better in New York or in Central City, Philadelphia, you know, maybe in inner San Francisco, but most of America, people spend an inordinate, in fact, they say 80% of their time in their home. So they're not out there meeting other people and engaging and developing a sense of community. And there's a lot of discussions about that. So that's kind of the focus of public space. What I get is a sense from the Tractat is that in creating an Eruv, in commingling the private and the public, or the private and the open, that what the Eruv is about is creating community. It's very much like the idea of public space in the West, but it comes out of the private. It emerges from the private as opposed to the public. So I think that's a big distinction, kind of different concept. And I think that relates to the notion that in the private space of the home and family who are observing the commandments on Shabbat, the private space has a degree of holiness. It has a kind of God-infused quality, a divine-infused quality to it. And that community comes about when people get together from that vantage point. The basis for community should not just be anything, which is more the Western idea. You know, community can arise in any which way. In the Talmud, it seems the basis for community in a Jewish sense of being together should arise from that kind of observance of the halakhic law and the kind of holiness that derives from it. And that then extends out into the public and open realm. So it's an infusing of the public realm with both the private qualities of the family, but really, I think maybe even more fundamentally, the family as an observant unit. And maybe it's a trusting that the family is a better place to start than the entire Jewish community. You know, you could have imagined maybe on some level, what about the synagogue, right? The synagogue is not a holy space in and of itself, but it's a place where you approach holiness like you do in the home. But the synagogue's not the origin point for the Eruv, it's the home. And I think that's very interesting. And I think that relates to the fact that the synagogue is more tenuous than the home, in that a lot of times we've had to retreat, you know, into our homes, into hiding, and into sort of a tight space because we live in often in times of oppression. You know, and especially you think about the authors of the Mishnah working, a few generations after the destruction and the Bar Kokhba rebellion, you know, and under really, really tight scrutiny on the part of Roman authorities. And this just doesn't stop, right? It goes on throughout, you know, the period, the Byzantines and then the Muslim conquest and the Christian lands. I think that aspect of, you know, it goes alongside a lot of the rationale for the Talmud altogether, right? Which is, how do you preserve a community without any real degree of political or military control? How do you keep people together and safe? So you have to keep them separate, right? And so the home becomes the place where that kind of separation occurs. You know, whereas in Christendom, it's, you know, the church is the source of holiness always, you know, and it's a sanctified space. It's literally holy. Whereas we don't have a holy space. We only have the movement toward holiness because our holy space was destroyed. And we start in a kind of small space, a modest space and a familial space and an individual space. And we go outward. The idea of not carrying things is also fascinating, right? You mention it to other people, you're not allowed to carry money and an umbrella ever, but then you can't carry keys without the Eruv. You can't have a baby carriage and a wheelchair, you know, all sorts of stuff. But I think I came upon one discussion of that, of the idea of not carrying, and it was really beautiful. What not carrying, and what really all the Shabbat, those 39 laws are about, is us not acting like constructors or builders or reshapers of the world. We're not supposed to remake nature on Shabbat. By carrying, we're not supposed to remake our own lives and the lives of others. And so by not carrying things, and then when we go out into an Eruv with carrying much less, we engage each other individually without the intercession of objects between us, which so often is the case, especially in modern consumerist culture, that on Shabbat, we're supposed to not have relations that are mediated by objects. I found that to be beautiful, you know, that idea that we're supposed to have direct relationships between individual, between people, and between people and their God. You know, those are the relationships that matter, not the relationships to objects.
Right. I've never thought of the prohibition of carrying on Shabbat that way. That is really beautiful. So thank you. Thank you for sharing that. In the article, you also raise the possibility that as cities change, Erevan could change even further. What does your Erevan of the future look like?
I was thinking then about light structures. One could actually create beams of light, and laser could be something that intangible. Clicks on and off. You click it on before Shabbat and you click it off after Shabbat. And
that's so cool.
And I thought of that. And now I thought of the screen and the whole internet world and cyberspace and, you know, I don't even know if the rabbis talk about cyberspace. Are contemporary rabbis talking about this as another type of space? Because look, we're in cyberspace now. So to what extent is the cyber dimension going to be incorporated, right? You know, what if you have avatars? Can you carry within the avatar space? And, you know, it seems like a whole set of, I think in the future, we could be getting more and more into this, especially when we get into not augmented reality as much, but more artificial reality. When people start spending time in artificial reality and moving in artificial reality, what happens when they start moving in artificial reality on Shabbat? What can they do? And what do the laws all apply within that? Will they apply? I mean, I bet you in 50 years, there'll be rulings and discussions about this because there will be people who'll be in artificial reality for long, long, long periods of time.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's a really interesting point. As learners of Daf Yomi embark on these highly technical discussions of measurement sizes and building specifications for the next 100 days or so, it can be difficult to appreciate the fuller picture of what they are reading. So how do you suggest they approach the text like an architectural historian to maybe appreciate the material a little more?
It would be like a question of contextualizing it, right? In a context like we're doing today. I think this is exactly what we're doing. You know, we're saying, here's this spatial, spiritual device, but there are others, and this is how it compares. You can understand it within a broader realm. So you understand the discourse on public and private space, which is so important. And so many architects, urbanists, planners, et cetera, are engaged in it. So bringing that into the picture, one of the key aspects to historical understanding is comparison. The minute you make a comparison, you put two things and you compare them, that they're somewhat similar, but they're different. And then you see things in the first thing that you were interested in that you wouldn't have seen before. Oh, and you see a new angle into it. And so that's what creating a context does. And I think that's probably helpful with the Eruv to actually contextualize it within the public-private discussions. I say to people, you know, what it has done for me is it gives me an insight into the creation of the Jewish mind, which is really profound, you know, that kind of painstaking questioning and every, you know, like almost like a 360 degree questioning of everything, you know, full scale, every possibility, every eventuality, any exception, you know, that's powerful. And I wouldn't have understood that if I hadn't, you know, gone into it a little bit. I tell my students this, the most complicated system that we know of in the universe is the human brain. It's the most complex form. And the most complex creation of the human brain are cities. They're incredibly complex and they're always changing and they don't change in a linear way or a cyclical way. I write a lot in the past few years on infrastructure. By infrastructure, I mean transportation networks, but also electricity networks, gas, postal service, because that's really what our world is all about, connections, right? So given the interconnectedness of the world, and given what I believe to be incredible Jewish wisdom that has been gained over several thousand years, that wisdom should be applied to the world too. It shouldn't be held separate. I want it to extend outward. I want the wisdom to go out and I want other things to come in.
Right, and that's the perfect way to end. Dr. Mitchell Schwartzer, thank you so much.
Thank you, it was a pleasure.
Between episodes, you can keep up with Interleaved on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you heard, leave us a review, subscribe, and share this with your friends. Special thanks to our executive producer, Adina Karp. Come back next time for another deep dive.